Russian forces launch a series of attacks across Ukraine over the weekend, including one that reduced to rubble the entire block of a residential building.
12 people were confirmed killed, including 5 children.
Plus, as Russia's presidential election approaches, the UN human rights chief calls for an end to the repression of independent voices.
Several candidates have been prevented from running due to alleged administrative irregularities. The death in prison of opposition leader Alexei Navalny adds to my serious concerns about his persecution.
And later in the program, despite the risks, why foreigners living in Ukraine have chosen to stay instead of going back to the safety of their own countries. Today is Monday, March 4th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London. President Volodymyr Zelensky is again urging Western allies to boost Ukraine's air defenses as Russian forces launched a series of drone attacks across the country over the weekend, including one in the southern port city of Odessa that destroyed an apartment building and killed at least a dozen civilians, including a number of children. Anna Ternikova in Kyiv joins us for an update.
Yeah, it was another really tough weekend. Russian forces launched drone attacks across the country and mostly in Odessa region, as well as in Kharkiv. And Kharkiv region, Donetsk region was under the missile attack. But definitely most of the attention was on Odessa because one of the drones hit the residential building. One block of the building was completely destroyed, and rescue operation for the civilians was taking place over the whole weekend, so for a couple of days. In the morning on Monday, Ukrainian authorities confirmed that rescue operation has been completed, and information about the victims is 12 people were confirmed killed, including 5 children out of those 12. And those children were really of such a small age. One boy was 4 months old, as well as one girl 7 months old, also children of 3, 8, and 10 years old. So Ukraine is in mourning these days, and the whole country, and of course Odessa region and Odessa in particular.
Oh, that's so sad. Turning now to Zaporizhia, Europe's largest nuclear power plant. My understanding is it's lost its connection to all of its external power lines 8 times in the past 18 months. And there is a, I guess you would call it an anniversary of Russia's takeover of the plant, and you were there getting an update. What can you tell us about that?
The 4th of March 2022 was the day when Russian forces occupied the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. It was for the first time in history of the nuclear plants that such a facility was under direct military assault, and the shelling and bombardment was happening on the territory and around the territory of the nuclear power plant, very close to the nuclear reactors. This is the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe. 6 reactors are in there, active reactors, and this was one of the main nuclear facility in Ukraine, one of the main nuclear asset in Ukraine before full-scale invasion began. And Ukrainian authorities, to mark 2 years since the occupation of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, made an update on the current situation and main issues, which were not only presented by the Ukrainian authorities, but also International Atomic Energy Agency and International Nuclear Community. And these are, of course, the security risks and security issues which are currently in place at the plant. So it was reported that there are a couple of main issues at this point. One, you mentioned that the external electricity connection is at risk. It's the last and only one line left active. So basically, if something is happening with this line, another blackout of the plant should be expected, and this is quite a worrying situation. Also, there is an issue with cooling water, with personnel, the experienced and licensed personnel personnel, which at this point is not present at the plant. At least this is what was reported, that no Ukrainian personnel is left at the plant. Also, there is an issue with the fact that there is military, which is present at the station, and also quite a lot of explosives on the territory of the plant. And last but not least, the fuel, which is currently located inside of the reactors, is getting to its expiry date, and it is a big question of how this fuel could be changed and replaced with a fresh one, because there is, again, as we as I already mentioned, there is no licensed personnel left at the station at this point.
All right. Well, thank you for the update. We'll keep an eye on this one. Anna Chernikova reporting for us from Kyiv. Thank you, as always. We appreciate the update.
Thank you, Laurie.
UN nuclear watchdog chief Rafael Grossi is heading to Moscow Tuesday for high-level talks with Russian officials on nuclear safety in Ukraine.
I've been to Kyiv many times. I've spoken many times with President Zelensky, with President Putin once, and also with other, with Minister Lavrov and others. What is happening there is of tremendous importance in terms of international peace and security.
Speaking to reporters Monday, Grossi said he intends to discuss Russia's plans for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant it is currently occupying in southeastern Ukraine. He said the situation there continues to be very fragile. The German government is vehemently rejecting all allegations that Russia's leak of a conversation by high-ranking German military officers was an indication Berlin was preparing for war against Russia. The government is at the same time trying to contain the domestic fallout from the leak, promising a quick investigation. For more on that story, we hear from Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan.
Speaking to Reuters on the phone, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the recording emphasized the direct involvement of the countries of the collective West in the conflict around Ukraine. Russian media last week published an audio recording of what they said was a meeting of senior German military officials discussing weapons for Ukraine and a potential strike by Kyiv on a bridge in Crimea. Germany has said it is investigating what it called an apparent act of eavesdropping by Russia. Germany's ambassador to Russia was seen going into Moscow's foreign ministry for a meeting on Monday. The envoy, Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, left without speaking to reporters. A spokesperson for the German foreign ministry denied Russian media reports that the ambassador had been summoned, saying the diplomat's appointment had been planned for some time. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius told reporters on Sunday that the interception and publication recording has been part of an information war that Russian President Vladimir Putin is waging.
It is a hybrid attack aimed at disinformation. It's about division. It's about undermining our unity. And accordingly, we should react to it with particular prudence, but no less determinedly.
Germany is among the NATO countries that have supplied weaponry to Ukraine, including tanks. Russia accuses what it calls the collective West of using Ukraine to wage a proxy war against it. NATO says it is helping Kyiv to defend itself against a war of aggression.
That was Olivia Chan with Reuters reporting. NATO kicked off an exercise Monday to defend its newly expanded Nordic territory when more than 20,000 soldiers from 13 nations take part in drills lasting nearly 2 weeks in the northern regions of Finland, Norway, and Sweden. The United States and NATO allies have increased force numbers as part of a push to deepen defenses across NATO's eastern flank. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb recently gained exclusive access to U.S. soldiers in Estonia as she crisscrossed the country to learn more about its defense.
They're the closest U.S. soldiers to Russia's border, training with live fires in NATO ally Estonia on how to take turf from an enemy.
The overall end state of this is the platoon seizing that key piece of terrain, which is that enemy trench line.
Let's go, first squad, move!
Let's go!
U.S. soldiers with the 101st Airborne Division eliminate simulated enemy scouts and defenses.
Fire in the hole!
At a training site less than 50 kilometers from Russia.
With any type of training exercise, we want to provide the most realistic training environment for our soldiers to better prepare them and our leaders for any type of challenges that are in the future.
through the breach, getting into the trench. Over.
Go. Team leader Liz Versova trains the platoon's weapons on the open field ahead.
Because we were expecting some enemy reinforcements, as well as a BMP-2, which is an infantry fighting vehicle.
They take that out with an AT-4, a weapon similar to the Javelin anti-tank missiles knocking out real armored vehicles in Ukraine.
Hey, target enemy, full cycler.
The enemy here is simulated, but the challenges are real. As soldiers used to desert warfare for the last 20 years build a new type of readiness.
A lot of the soldiers have not seen snow before in their entire lives, so being thrown into this environment can be challenging.
About 200 kilometers northwest, American HIMARS, multiple rocket launchers with the 1st Infantry Division, stand guard, sentinels shrouded by pines.
These HIMARS and their operators arrived in December as part of the U.S. military's enhanced presence in the Baltics. At the beginning of last year, there were 600 American troops in the three Baltic nations. Now, there are about 1,500. This is how Estonia prepares for war. But because they're a member of NATO, they wouldn't go it alone. And NATO allies are fully integrated into the exercise.
Estonians defend trenches that French forces try to seize. British troops clear the way for Danish Leopard 2 tanks to punch through simulated defenses. Tanks similar to the ones soon to be seen on the Ukrainian battlefield. NATO allies hope the Leopards, along with Britain's Challenger 2 tanks, will give Ukrainians more power and protection than the Soviet-made tanks currently in the fight.
The battles in the Ukraine will be slow, and what you need a heavy tank, like Challenger, that can take a hit, more so than a T-72, which will probably be destroyed after one round. Challenger can take multiple hits and stay in the fight.
But training Ukrainians to use these tanks effectively won't happen overnight.
Well, tanks are much weighted, we know that, and I really hope that we are just not too late for that. Russians still have, even they have lost more than 2,000 tanks, they still have thousands of tanks in the stocks they can bring to Ukraine. They still have missiles, they still have rockets, which means that, of course, Ukraine needs as much help as we can give.
Estonia's defense minister tells VOA his country has spent 1% of its entire GDP supporting Ukraine. And nearly 3% of GDP on self-defense.
We have a clear understanding that every tank destroyed in Ukraine is one tank less behind our border.
How worried are you that Russia could attack here?
Well, we have to be ready. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, we are like the front door of NATO. And when the front door is locked, then it's safe to be inside of the house. So simple is that.
A message NATO allies have taken to heart as increased defenses pour in. Carla Babb, VOA News, Tapa, Estonia.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk on Monday called for a quick end to the, quote, repression of independent voices in Russia.
Since the onset of Russia's war on Ukraine, thousands of politicians, journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, and people who have simply spoken their minds on social media have faced administrative and criminal charges, and this trend appears to have worsened in recent months, with many cultural figures being targeted.
He said Russian authorities have further intensified their repression of dissenting voices prior to this month's upcoming presidential election.
Several candidates have been prevented from running due to alleged administrative irregularities. The death in prison of opposition leader Alexei Navalny adds to my serious concerns about his persecution.
Meanwhile, the parents and supporters of Alexei Navalny bid farewell to the Russian opposition leader at a funeral in Moscow Friday, following a battle with authorities over the release of his body after his still unexplained death in an Arctic penal colony. Under heavy police presence, thousands lined up to pay their final respects. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Alexei Navalny's parents held hands as a priest administered funeral rites over the body of their 47-year-old son Friday. Barricades and a heavy police presence surrounded the Moscow church. Only family members and close friends of the opposition leader were allowed in the church and later a nearby cemetery for his burial. But outside, a large crowd of Navalny supporters defied authorities and risked arrest to pay their last respects, clapping and chanting, "No to war," "Navalny," and "Putin is a murderer." Pallbearers carried Navalny's coffin from the church. And a large crowd of mourners walked from the church to the cemetery, chanting, "Free political prisoners." Thousands of supporters, and possibly tens of thousands, turned out despite the risk of arrest and repercussions. One expert told VOA she was amazed at the size of the crowd. Mary Glantz is the acting director of the Center for Russia and Europe at the United States Institute of Peace. She spoke to VOA via Zoom.
People lining up for kilometers along the road to the cemetery where he is being buried. And so these people are risking imprisonment to go out and support Alexei Navalny and to actually at times even go against the war.
The Kremlin has denied any state involvement in his death in an Arctic penal colony, where he was often held in isolation. Asked for his assessment of Navalny as a political figure, spokesperson Dmitry Peskov declined to comment, saying only, "Unauthorized gatherings will violate the law, but those who will participate in them will be held accountable in accordance with the current law." Experts say authorities will have surveillance video, and there may be arrests in the days and weeks to come. Police blocked a massive crowd hoping to enter Borisovo Cemetery, where Navalny was laid to rest. Earlier, U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, went to the church to pay her respects, along with the German and French ambassadors to Russia. Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, and their two children were not able to travel to Russia for the funeral, but she turned to social media to say an emotional goodbye. Mary Glantz says she expects Navalnaya to take up the challenge of leading the opposition to Putin's repression.
I think she's formidable and will present a continuing challenge to the regime as she takes up his mantle and continues his work.
After her husband's death 2 weeks ago, Yulia Navalnaya said, quote, "By killing Alexei, Putin killed half of me, half of my heart and half of my soul. But I still have the other half, and that tells me I have no right to give up." Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has put many of the nation's most at-risk patients in even greater danger, especially young cancer patients. But a Ukrainian charity working with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in the U.S. is helping some Ukrainian kids receive care around the world. Irina Shinkarenka has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
13-year-old Alexander Batanov has blood cancer. He was evacuated from Kharkiv to Kiev in January 2023. 7-year-old Kristina Pyzhik was evacuated to the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in March 2022. Both trips were made possible by the hospital and Tabletochki Foundation, a Kiev-based nonprofit that helps Ukrainian children diagnosed with cancer. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Alexander, Sasha for short, was at home in the Kharkiv region, bedridden. His mother, Natalia Batanova, says doctors initially thought he had a spinal fracture.
We closed all the windows. Our son was on the floor, lying on mattresses, in pain. We slept fully dressed. Windows would shatter, the door would open from blast waves. The roof shook. We couldn't take Sasha even to the basement. He couldn't move.
When they finally made it to the hospital, doctors learned the boy had blood cancer. So amid a war, Sasha started his own fight against the disease, first at the Kharkiv hospital and then at the Ahmad Did Children's Hospital in Kiev. His evacuation and treatment were made possible by the Tabletochki Foundation. Alexander Batanov recalls his experience.
Hospital number 16 had large generators, so I guess we didn't have big issues.
Today, Sasha doesn't like talking about problems. Instead, he supports his mom, who worries about him, and his dad, who's been fighting at the front lines since day one of the invasion. Natalia Batanova says things have been tough, but they're doing the best they can.
We go through everything, despair, everything. At times Sasha is supporting me, at times I'm supporting him. We take turns and we make it work. That's love, and it will win.
Last spring, Sasha underwent a bone marrow transplant in Kyiv, where he now lives. He dreams of a full recovery and wants his dad to return home from the front.
Can you say how you like it here in America? You like it?
I learned some English.
7-year-old Kristina Pyzhyk was undergoing chemotherapy in Lviv when Russia invaded. She has suffered from an optic nerve tumor since she was 2. After the invasion, the family lost a chance to get Kristina's treatment delivered to Ukraine. Maria Pyzhyk is Kristina's mom.
It was tough at the beginning. War, no access to her medication. We left Ukraine, but we didn't know where we are going, how we are going to manage.
Before the war, Kristina and some other kids received medications thanks to benefactors. Vyacheslav Bykov is the CEO of Tabletochki Foundation.
After Russia invaded, sending medication became impossible. Closed skies, huge lines at the border, lack of good refrigerators. The only solution was to send the child abroad.
Tabletochki Foundation CEO Vyacheslav Bykov says 1,200 Ukrainian children were undergoing active cancer treatment when Russia invaded, and most of them were evacuated to other countries so they could continue to receive treatment. Kristina and 7 more Ukrainians ended up at St. Jude Children's Hospital in the U.S. state of Tennessee. For Irina Shinkarenko in Washington, NRIs. VOA News.
And finally today, many foreigners living in embattled Ukraine have chosen to stay and face the threat of shelling instead of returning to relative safety of their home countries. VOA met up with citizens of the United States and Denmark to find out why they decided to stay in Ukraine. Leja Bakaletz has their stories from Kyiv.
From Capitol Hill in Washington to a cold warehouse on the outskirts of Kyiv, Ukraine, Stephen Moore, a former chief of staff to a member of Congress, knew where he had to be after Russia invaded on February 24, 2022.
So I hopped on a plane and got to Ukraine on day 5 of the war.
And he came bearing supplies.
I bought like binoculars, walkie-talkies, flashlights of all kinds, and this sort of thing, medical supplies. And I just stuffed them into like 4 suitcases, 4 really big suitcases.
As Moore was trying to get into Ukraine, people were waiting in long lines trying to get out. On his first visit, Moore brought supplies he paid for himself. Later, he eventually created a nonprofit in the U.S. and relocated to Kyiv. Moore explains what drew him to do it.
2 things. Я люблю Україну. I love Ukraine. And part of the reason is because, you know, freedom is a very important core value to me. And so I see the Ukrainians fighting for their freedom.
Moore informs his former Capitol Hill colleagues about what's really going on in Ukraine. Since September, he's visited about 100 congressional offices.
America is living under the illusion that it has the choice of whether or not to participate in wars in Europe and the Middle East. And the choice is not yes or no. The choice is whether we send relatively inexpensive weapons now or whether we send troops, the lives of our sons and daughters, because Putin is not going to stop with Ukraine.
Moore isn't moving back to his homeland anytime soon. Neither is Karen Marie Kragland from Denmark, who says Kyiv is her home city now. We met with Kragland right after her Ukrainian lesson. She is fluent in Russian, but after years in Ukraine, she wants to speak its official language.
I came here to join the IT industry, and some 6 years ago, I started my own business where I advise companies on organizational transformation and change management. Actually, next week, I have my 17th anniversary here.
When the shooting in Kyiv began at the start of the war, she fled to the west of Ukraine and later took a job in the Netherlands. After a year, she decided she had to return to Ukraine.
You know, we crossed the border. It was just this immense inner peace to be back on Ukrainian soil. And I was like, yes. I feel semi-Ukrainian by now. I can make a difference here.
When talking about the conflict, Kragland speaks of our war. She wants to help Ukraine as much as possible.
Financially, obviously, is one way of helping. Another way of helping is to advise organizations here. I'm currently working with a very large NGO, working with them on strengthening their organization.
Both Moore and Kragland say while their friends and relatives don't understand their choice to live in a war zone, they stop trying to persuade them to return to their motherlands. Lesya Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
And that's all the time we have for today, but stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.